Welcome to the Freedom Trail Podcast, brought to you by the Freedom Trail Foundation and the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Episode 1, The Boston Massacre, featuring The Bloody Massacre on King Street, an audio play by Sam Jones, performed by the Freedom Trail Players. Also, an interview with Samantha Nelson, Director of Programs and Education at the Bostonian Society on the reenactment of the Boston Massacre, and a summary of events around the Boston Massacre with Robert Allison, Professor and Chair of the History Department at Suffolk University. Part 1, The Bloody Massacre on King Street.
Please note, the dialogue in the following teleplay is almost entirely composed of the words actually spoken on the night of the Boston Massacre, as reported by trial testimony. In the interest of greater historic accuracy, graphic language spoken by Bostonians and Redcoats on that fateful night has not been edited.
Herman Melville once referred to John Brown's bloody attempt to capture Harper's Ferry in 1859 as the meteor of the Civil War. In the 18th century, the Boston Massacre was a similar shocking act of bloodshed and a similar harbinger of the far greater bloodshed that was to come in the Revolutionary War. In both cases, there had been conflict that preceded the event, even violence, and yet both events seemed to come out of nowhere and shocked the American people greatly, throwing into bold relief just how far their bonds with their former countrymen had decayed. The second half of the 1760s had been tumultuous for Boston. The 29th and 14th Regiments of Foot had arrived in Boston in October of 1768, sent to restore order in the colony and enforce controversial taxes in the wake of the Stamp Act riots of 1765. The introduction of British redcoats to Boston was like lighting a fuse. An explosion was only a matter of time. On March 3rd, a bloody fistfight erupted between 30 redcoats of His Majesty's 29th Regiment and the sailors of John Gray's Ropewalk. In the aftermath of the Donnybrook, rumors swirled of further trouble, and on the morning of the 5th, an ominous handbill was posted around Boston.
This is to inform ye rebellious people in Boston that the soldiers in the 14th and 29th Regiments are determined to join together and defend themselves against all who oppose them.
It was in this volatile atmosphere that what came to be known as the Boston Massacre unfolded. It was as the day drew to a close that things began to escalate again. Because of the trial that followed and the transcripts of witness testimony survive, the course of events can be traced through the words of the participants. The following teleplay will present the Boston Massacre through the words that were spoken that day by those who were there.
Edward Garrick, a wig maker's apprentice.
Private Hugh White, standing guard outside Boston's customs house.
Henry Knox, a Boston bookseller who would go on to become a general in the Continental Army.
Richard Palms, referred to by John Adams as the most important witness of the massacre.
Benjamin Burdick, a Bostonian of Scottish extraction.
And wife?
Private Ian Montgomery, one of two redcoats eventually found guilty of manslaughter in the trial that followed the massacre.
Captain Thomas Preston, commander of the troops that fired in the Boston Massacre.
Evening in Boston, March 5th. Private Hugh White stood guard at a sentry box outside Boston's Customs House in King Street. Edward Garrick, a wigmaker's apprentice, spotted one of his master's customers, Captain Goldfinch.
Here now, you see that fellow there? He won't pay me master for dressing his hair. He is mean and owes money.
Captain Goldfinch is a gentleman and will pay what he owes.
There are no gentlemen in the 29th.
Let me see your face.
I'm not ashamed to show my face. Ah! Why did you strike me? What do you mean by abusing the people in this way?
Damn you, if you do not get out of the way, I will give you something.
Here, did you see that?
Lousy rascal.
Lobster son of a bitch.
Damned rascally scoundrel lobster son of a bitch.
Come now, let the sentry alone.
As a crowd began to draw around the taunting apprentices, Private White had become frightened of being carried off of his post, and retreated to the customs house steps, loading his musket and fixing his bayonet. Several Bostonians, Henry Knox among them, tried to caution the agitated sentry.
If you fire, you must die for it.
Damn them, if they molest me, I will fire.
Be not afraid, they're just boys, young shavers. They won't harm you.
I tell you, if the boys do not disperse, there will be something by and by.
There's the son of a
bitch that knocked me down!
Kill him! Kill him! Knock him down!
Fire, damn you, fire! You dare not fire!
Turn out, main guard!
Word that something was afoot spread quickly about the town. The bells began to ring, and the cry, "Town born, turn out! Town born, turn out!" was heard shouted in the streets. Benjamin Burdick, a Scottish immigrant, was preparing to venture out when he was stopped by his wife.
Husband, what are you about?
You hear the bells? 'Tis a fire. I must go.
It is not a fire. It's an affray in King Street. Oh, if you are going, take your sword.
As crowds of Bostonians began to gather and move towards King Street, Captain Preston of the 29th tried to rally the 7 redcoats he had gathered to relieve the beleaguered Private White.
Damn your bloods! Why won't you turn out? We must go to the assistance of the sentry. Make way. Stand out of our way.
Is this the fire that is cried of? Why are you pushing at me? What do you mean by coming on me in this manner?
Damn you, stand out of our way.
I have offended no one and will move for no man under the heavens.
With their bayonets fixed, the redcoats made their way through the crowd that had gathered round the customs house. Once they had reached Private White, they formed a semicircular line with their flanks against the customs house. The crowd pressed in upon them angrily. Henry Knox and others tried to caution the redcoats as ice and snowballs came flying from the crowd.
For God's sake, take your men back again. For if they fire, your life must be answerable for the consequence.
I am sensible of it. I know what I am about.
What's all this, Private White?
Go home or you'll be killed.
Heave snowballs. They dare not fire.
Are your soldiers' guns loaded?
With powder and ball.
Sir, I hope you don't intend the soldiers shall fire on the inhabitants.
By no means, by no means. I stand in front of them. If they fire, I must fall. A sacrifice.
Are your guns loaded?
Yes.
Do you intend to fire?
Yes, by the eternal God.
A tall mulatto sailor who called himself Michael Johnson pushed to the front, brandishing a club.
Huzzah! They dare not fire! We are not afraid of them!
Fire! You can't kill us all! Fire and be damned! Fire! Fire!
Kill the dogs! Knock them over!
At that moment, a club flew through the air and struck Private Montgomery. He fell to the ground and dropped his musket, snatching it up again. In anger and fear, Montgomery cried out,
"Damn your bloods! Fire! Be the consequence what it will!"
Stop firing! Do not fire! Damn ye rascals, what did you fire for?
I want to see some faces I may swear to another day.
Perhaps, you may.
When the smoke from the black powder cleared away, 5 lay dead or dying. Michael Johnson, better known as Crispus Attucks, was the first to fall. Samuel Gray, Samuel Maverick, James Caldwell, and Patrick Carr would join the grim tally, 5 dead, killed by British soldiers in the streets of Boston. The town was filled with anger, and Governor Thomas Hutchinson was forced to remove all the soldiers to Castle Island in the harbor for their own safety. In the trial that followed, however, John Adams used the testimony of Richard Palms and others to show that Preston had never ordered the redcoats to fire, and that the soldiers had done so to defend their own lives. Whatever his own feelings about the British occupation may have been, Adams famously declared,
"Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictums of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence."
Adams called his defense of the redcoats the proudest service I have ever done my country, and today it is commonly judged that the verdict he achieved was just. And yet, as Bostonian Mary Clapham made clear in a poem she displayed on March 5, 1771, the Boston Massacre was still on trial in the hearts and minds of the American people.
"Ask not where Preston or his butchers are, but ask who brought these bloody villains here."
Clapham's words show very clearly that Americans were ready to dispense with the pawns and return a guilty verdict on a far greater indictment, an indictment of their continued relations with Great Britain, that would result in separation. In retrospect, March 5th of 1770 seems to mark the tipping point as events teetered on the precipice of revolution, the point from which there could be no return to things as they had been.
Part 2. An interview with Samantha Nelson, Director of Programs and Education at the Bostonian Society.
So first off, if you could just explain what the Bostonian Society is and what you guys do.
Sure. Well, the Bostonian Society is the organization that operates the Old State House Museum. It was established, actually, in the early 1880s in order to save the Old State House from demolition. And it's been operating the building as a museum ever since.
And running the Old State House here in pretty close proximity to the Boston Massacre site, which kind of leads us to what I wanted to talk about today. The Boston Massacre commemoration is coming up, and you guys are pretty involved with that. So what's happening? What are you guys doing?
Sure. Well, it's the 242nd anniversary of the Boston Massacre coming up in just a few weeks. So we have a number of events planned. Although the anniversary of the Boston Massacre is March 5th, we are celebrating the anniversary on the following Saturday, so March 10th. And so we have a number of events. During the day, we will have a series of programs for children and families. At 11 o'clock and 2 o'clock, we will be holding a kids' reenactment of the Boston Massacre. We'll be kind of talking through the event and having kids play it out. And following each of those reenactments, we'll move inside to reenact the trial of the British soldiers who were involved in the massacre. Those programs will immediately follow the kids' reenactment. And then later on in the evening, there will be a reenactment of the event itself with members of the reenactment community from around the area. And actually, this is news. We've just heard word that there's going to be the city's going to have a dedication ceremony. Just this past fall, there was the Boston Massacre site was completely reorganized. The intersection in front of the Old State House, which is the site of the Boston Massacre, was reconfigured to be more pedestrian friendly. And so they've moved the marker around, they've added some signage. So we do believe the mayor will be on hand to do a dedication sometime in the afternoon.
Yeah, and that's really huge, the redoing of the memorial. For those who don't know, the Boston Massacre Memorial was kind of just a circle in the street on an island that was kind of not pedestrian friendly. And what are the changes that have been made specifically?
Yeah, well, we're really excited about it. Previously, the circle of cobblestones was kind of in the middle of the intersection, was very difficult to access, but now now it's all pedestrian area. So one of the streets that crossed in front of the Old State House has been cut off to road traffic, and instead it's been built out as sidewalk. And the circle of cobblestones has moved a little closer to the Old State House, but now it's clearly marked as the site of the Boston Massacre. So now visitors are able to recognize it, are able to go out to it, take a look at it safely, and to know what it is, which has been a problem for a number of years now.
Now, you mentioned there's a kids' reenactment, and then there's the reenactment. What's the main difference between those two? Is the nighttime one not child appropriate, or
they're all family friendly? But the daytime event will actually have children, visitors, playing the roles of the soldiers, playing the roles of the crowd, and we'll be talking through what happened as the kids are playing out these roles. Whereas in the evening, it'll be adult reenactors, members of the reenactment community who are playing the roles, and it's actually quite a dramatic setup. We'll be blocking off a lot of the streets. There'll be a sound system, and we'll actually have a pre-event drama, a skit, that will help illustrate some of the troubles that the people in Boston were having with the British troops being in town, problems with British policies, and so those will kind of be shared through the skit before the actual reenactment of the event takes place.
And as far as the crowd in the reenactments. If you come to this reenactment at night, what role are you playing as an audience member? Are you just standing there and watching, or do you get to do anything?
Oh, yeah, no, we encourage our spectators to participate, you know, as if they were a member of the crowd. Now, we do have barriers for safety, but we do encourage spectators to, you know, jeer at the British soldiers as they come out, or perhaps we have loyalists in our crowd, and so perhaps they should be encouraging the crowd to settle down, to disperse. So we do encourage our spectators to participate and vocally and through we have other reenactors who are interspersed throughout the crowd to help explain what's going on and to encourage people to participate.
So why is it important to do these kinds of events?
So that's a great question. So there's, I think, a number of reasons to do these events. I mean, first of all, the Boston Massacre is a well-known event. It's something we all learn about in school, and so it's something people get pretty excited about. And so it's a way to bring people to the Old State House, to the Boston Massacre site, and so it's an awareness event for us. But I think even more importantly, it helps people get excited about history. This is a very dramatic and exciting event that we're inviting people to witness and to be part of. And you know, the Boston Massacre is a very complex event, and you know, we do try to get that across as best as we can through this reenactment. I mean, there's so many nuances, there's so many subtleties, and you know, this event really illustrates how history is so much a matter of perspective, and how all events around us happening all the time understanding them is a matter of perspective. So we hope that by having this event that is exciting and fun, will make people excited about learning about the Boston Massacre and other events, and will really inspire a real love for history and a love for learning more about it.
What kind of crowds can we expect at this event?
Yeah, well, we get all kinds of people, a lot of visitors coming from out of town that, you know, are lucky to have come on this day, but a lot of locals, a lot of families, a lot of college students. We find that this is kind of a fun, quirky event to do on a Saturday night. We do see several hundred people. Often it depends on the weather, but we've been very lucky these past few years and had great weather, and we hope to have the same this year.
And how long does it go?
It's about 30 to 40 minutes.
Easy enough.
Yeah.
Still out in time for party.
That's right.
What if you can't make the reenactment? Are there other ways to explore the Boston Massacre through the Bostonian Society and Old State House?
Yeah, the Boston Massacre is an event that we interpret to a great extent at the Old State House. We do have an exhibit all about the Boston Massacre, kind of an object theater presentation. And we also have tours of the Boston Massacre site that we offer throughout the day, every day.
And I just got a couple other Bostonian-related questions for you, just because I know you've been there a while. I know you have a favorite. This isn't related to the massacre, but I know you have a favorite artifact that is pretty cool and on display. So I just figured I'd ask.
Sure.
About it.
Well, my favorite object. Well, you see, the Bostonian Society has been around a long time and collected many, many objects related to many aspects of Boston's history. So my favorite object is not something that's related to the American Revolution at all, but is related to the abolitionist period. We actually, in our collection, we have the cane that was used to beat up Charles Sumner on the Senate floor in 1856. So I think that is a very powerful object that, you know, regardless of all the debates and conflicts there are in our Congress today, we can't imagine senators actually breaking out into a full fight on the Senate floor. So I think it really, really shows what kind of issue slavery really was at that time. I mean, it was something that, well, it divided the nation.
And that also brings up all the other artifacts you guys have. You have so many great things on display. What revolution era stuff is on display that's really, really sticks out to you for at the Bostonian
yeah.
Society?
Well, going back to the Boston Massacre, we do have a print from the Paul Revere engraving of the Boston Massacre. That is probably one of our most well-known objects, and of course very related to the event that's coming up. And we have another image of the Boston Massacre, which is also a very different depiction, also an abolition era object. And it's although Paul Revere had a very distinct message when he was creating his image. He was trying to, of course, make the British soldiers look as terrible as possible to unite colonists against British authority. But this other image depicts Crispus Attucks, who was one of the victims of the Boston Massacre. He was part African-American, part Native American, a former slave. And he's very prominently depicted in this image of the Boston Massacre as a message that he, as a former slave, was involved in this fight for freedom, and therefore, you know, aren't all citizens entitled to the same rights and liberties. So we have these objects related to the Boston Massacre, which I think are very special.
Great. And the Boston Massacre reenactment events are going on all day on March 10th, 2012. But the main event is at 7 p.m. in the streets of Boston, right on State Street outside the old State House. So make that if you can. Samantha, thanks so much for coming out and talking to us. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You can learn more about the Bostonian Society and its work at bostonhistory.org or by becoming a fan on Facebook. Search Bostonian Society. Part 3, interview with Robert Allison, professor and chair of the History Department at Suffolk University and author of The American Revolution, A Concise History, and The Boston Massacre. So, Professor, what is the Boston Massacre, and how did it happen?
Boston Massacre happened on March 5th of 1770. It was a Monday night. Group of a mob of angry colonists confronted first a British sentry in front of the custom house, and then seven British soldiers who came to his rescue, and in the melee that followed, the soldiers opened fire, and three of the colonists in the mob were killed instantly. Two of them died later, so there were five casualties and about a dozen men seriously wounded. And so that was the Boston Massacre, happened on March 5th of 1770.
And how did that happen? Like, what was the situation that led to an event like that occurring?
Well, there are a number of different versions of how exactly this came to be. In fact, there were two published reports that came out shortly after it. One published by the town of Boston, which called it the Horrid Massacre, and said the trouble began in 1767 when three customs agents, customs commissioners, arrived in Boston. Things were very tense, and the governor of Massachusetts, Francis Bernard, knew he needed military force to help protect the customs commissioners, so two regiments of British troops arrived in 1768, and there was constant tension between these 2,000 soldiers and the 12,000 or so Bostonians, and tension over the course of 2 years, as there's also a non-importation movement going on as the colonists are trying to boycott British goods that have been taxed under the customs regulations passed in 1767. So there is this kind of political tension going on, plus the fact that there are 2,000 troops, plus the economy is suffering, and the troops are competing for jobs with the colonists. Tension, and in February there is a riot at the shop of an importer, Theophilus Lilly. And in the course of this riot, a 12-year-old boy is killed, Christopher Sider, killed by a customs informer, Ebenezer Richardson. And the crowd wants to lynch Richardson. Instead, he is taken to jail, and trial keeps getting postponed. So there's this tension. And then actually the death of Christopher Sider, which Samuel Adams turns into a major event. He has a funeral arranged for Sider from Faneuil Hall, with 200 Boston schoolboys escorting the casket, and several thousand Bostonians, largest public funeral held up to this point. This is the atmosphere in Boston, this tense atmosphere, tension between soldiers and colonists, tension over these customs regulations, and it blows up. Benjamin Franklin had said when the troops were sent to Boston that sending troops to keep peace in Boston is like setting up a blacksmith's forge in a gunpowder magazine. And he said that the soldiers probably won't put down any rebellion, they'll probably start one. That's the kind of atmosphere we have. So on the Friday morning of March, would have been March the 2nd, it's actually a fight breaks out at a rope works in the south end of Boston. A soldier's walking past, a group of rope workers standing around. One of them says to the soldier, "Hey, you looking for work?" Because the soldiers always are looking for work. They're poorly paid, they're not doing anything, they're just on garrison duty. So the guy says, "Sure, I could use a few bucks," and the rope worker says, "Oh, you can clean the shit house." And the other rope worker thinks that's really funny. They start laughing. The soldier realizes he's been insulted, so he takes a swing at the guy who had insulted him, ignoring at the moment that there are about a dozen other rope workers standing around, and they proceed to pummel this soldier. And he does get away, goes back to the barracks, comes back with about a dozen soldiers. They go at it again with the rope workers. The rope workers beat them up. The rope workers are tough guys. You know, rope working, it's an entry-level, unskilled occupation. So these are guys who work with their hands, and, you know, they're looking for a fight. The soldiers now are looking for a fight. And then all weekend, fights are breaking out between soldiers and rope workers, and rumors spread about, you know, soldiers being kidnapped or rope workers being attacked, and great tension all weekend. And on Monday morning, someone posts a notice around town saying, "Citizens of Boston, stay off the streets if you know what's good for you," and signed "Soldiers of His Majesty's 12th and 29th Regiments." So that's what's behind this. And on the night of March the 5th, crowd gathers in front of Faneuil Hall. And it's around sunset, cold March night, and people remember the sound of the livestock pens inside Faneuil Hall being pulled apart. These are now apprentices, teenagers, are looking for weapons to use against the soldiers. And then they go attack the main British barracks. Many of the British troops are housed in a sugar warehouse in Brattle Square, roughly where the Government Center T station is now. So these mobs, several hundred guys, are going to attack a British barracks. The soldiers are behind a fence as the mob are throwing things over the fence, trying to hit them, breaking windows, and Colonel Goldfinch, who's in charge of the other British regiment, comes along. And he tells these guys, the soldiers, go inside, because he knows this crowd, they're just throwing things at a building. They'll lose interest in that. Right now, the crowd's having fun throwing things at actual soldiers. The soldiers know they can't fire at this crowd. They do bring out a gun kind of to threaten the crowd, but it doesn't really work. The soldiers do go inside, and the crowd loses interest and starts filing away. Different things happen as the crowd's filing away. A boy falls to the ground, his face is bloodied. People coming onto the scene see this and think the soldiers have committed an atrocity. What essentially is an attack on a barracks. This is a crowd that's ready to take on a British barracks. It's not like they're afraid of anything. But they do disperse. Goldfinch tells the soldiers, go inside, and soldiers do. Crowd loses interest. Meanwhile, in Dock Square, which is in front of the old State House, there's also the Customs House is there, and there's one British soldier, Private Hugh White, in front of the Customs House. And a group of apprentices come along. They see one British soldier. They decide to have some fun with him. So they start taunting him, telling him that, they start calling him names. And Colonel Goldfinch walks through the square at this point. And one of the kids is an apprentice to a barber. And he says to Colonel Goldfinch, "You didn't pay the barber's bill." And Goldfinch actually had the barber's receipt in his pocket. He had paid the barber's bill, but he's a British officer. He doesn't get into arguments in the street with, you know, apprentices. And Goldfinch just walks away. And the apprentice then turns on Private White and says, "Your officer didn't pay his bill. He is no gentleman." In the 18th century, that was the worst thing you could say about someone. He's not a gentleman. And who are you if you're a soldier under a gentleman? And you're under his very rigid discipline. So we start calling him a bloody back. That is, your back is bloody from being whipped. Or there's some speculation that called him lobster backs, saying, who buys lobster? You know, lobster, kind of a trash fish. That's one meaning of it. Also, your back is red because it's been whipped. Also, you're wearing a red coat, but taunting him, calling him names like this. And Private White has these kids now crowding around him. And a local magistrate comes on the scene, and White thinks maybe the magistrate will tell the kids to go away. He says, "Hey, can you tell the kids to go away?" And the magistrate says, "Oh, they're only boys. They won't hurt you." And the magistrate hurries away. So Private White now has more of these apprentices. They see they're really getting the upper hand here. And finally, White pushes at this kid with his gun. The kid falls to the ground, and just at that moment, the crowd that had been attacking the barracks comes around the corner, and what do they see but a British soldier pushing a poor, innocent child to the ground. Now the crowd surrounds White. They crowd in on White, and someone goes to another British barracks to warn the guard there that this guy's about to get killed in front of the customs house. So Thomas Preston, a British captain, gathers up seven soldiers, and then they march single file down King Street through the crowd. And their idea is they'll get to the front of the customs house. White will fall in with them. They'll march back to the barracks. They'll get off the streets. There won't be any trouble. The British knew they had to get off the streets. They shouldn't wear their uniforms out on the streets because soldiers are getting jumped by angry Bostonians. So Captain Preston leads the men to the front of the custom house. White falls in, and then the crowd closes in around them. There are now several hundred people in this square surrounding these nine soldiers, Captain Preston and the eight soldiers. And these people had come armed. They have clubs, they have swords, they have other things. And they're throwing things at the soldiers. People remember the sound of the rattling sound as the rocks hit the guns the soldiers are holding in front of them and bounced off. You know, see how many rocks you need to throw at someone holding a piece of metal in front of them to make a rattling sound. Soldiers are getting hit more than the guns are. And someone goes into the first church and starts ringing the bell, which is the signal for fire. So people think there's a fire. When there's a fire, you have to get out of your house and go find out where the fire is so you can put it out. So people are now crowding into the square saying, where's the fire? They see the crowd, think this must be where the fire is. So people are yelling, where's the fire? Meanwhile, at the front of the crowd, the mob is yelling to the soldiers, why don't you fire? You don't dare fire. You won't fire, because they know they can't fire. Under the law, these soldiers cannot fire at a crowd until a magistrate has come on the scene and proclaimed that this is a riot. They've read the Riot Act. And once the Riot Act has been read, the crowd has to disperse within an hour. If the crowd doesn't disperse an hour after the Riot Act is read, then the soldiers can fire. So the crowd knows this. First, we have to have someone come on and read the Riot Act. Then we have an hour. We can do a lot in an hour. So this is what's happening here. We have people coming in saying, where's the fire? The crowd, the mob saying, you don't dare fire. Now, at the front, Crispus Attucks, who is an African Native American mulatto, his mother was Native American, his father was African, runaway slave, he had been a sailor, he's at the front. He had been, someone remembered Attucks coming up King Street holding two big clubs, and he handed one to this witness and said, let's go get him. Now he's at the front, right in front of Private Montgomery, telling Montgomery, you don't dare fire, getting right in Montgomery's face, trying to grab his gun away from him. Someone off to the right throws something through the air that hits Montgomery in the side of the head, practically knocks him to the ground. He gets up and he says, God damn you, I will fire. And he does. Soldier standing next to him, here's the Matthew Kilroy, here's the gun, and he fires too. Captain Preston is shocked. He says, why did you fire? Now the other soldiers here, they've heard the guns going off. They think they've been ordered to fire. So, and then they hear Preston saying, why did you fire? They think they've been given the order to fire, so they fire. Then Preston gets in front of the soldiers, says, don't fire. And he marches the soldiers back to the barracks. This is the scene. Attucks dies instantly. Thomas Gray, a rope worker, dies. Matthew Kilroy also dies. Across the street, Patrick Carr, who was a rope worker. Actually, he was a rope worker from Ireland. He saw the way things were going. He had seen lots of mobs in Ireland, and he knew this wouldn't end well. So he was on his way out of the crowd. He's shot in the back. Samuel Maverick, a 17-year-old apprentice, also is on his way out of the crowd. A bullet ricochets and hits him. Across the street, a couple of people are shot. Once Captain Preston has gotten control over his soldiers, people realize now that they've either been shot or there are people dead in the street, the crowd calms down. The crowd gets kind of subdued. Thomas Hutchinson, the lieutenant governor, arrives on the scene, and he goes into the old state house, climbs to the balcony, and tells everyone to go home. And he says, the law will take its course. I will live and die by the law. Go home. And he spends the rest of the night hearing witnesses as to what happened.
Now, that story is, you know, it's exciting and kind of wild and sounds like a bunch of kind of varied in class people, a mob, descending on a bunch of soldiers. That isn't the depiction we're used to. There's a pretty famous picture that was engraved by Paul Revere. How did that become the symbol of the massacre if that isn't what happened?
Well, Samuel Adams, who is a leader of the Boston Town Meeting, immediately recognizes that this is a major event. And just as Thomas Hutchinson is taking hearing witnesses, Adams and the town of Boston also are taking depositions from people. And Adams sees this will be what we can use to get the British soldiers out of town. And Revere, actually two things happen with Revere. One, he is commissioned by the court. Okay, so Revere draws the crime scene.
Sure.
And it's very accurate. It shows where the soldiers are. It shows where the bodies are. Also, Henry Pelham, who is a local artist, has an idea of doing this a propaganda piece. So Pelham does a watercolor, which he calls The Fruits of Arbitrary Power. And it shows the soldiers in straight formation in the middle of King Street. And the crowd, this civilian crowd, unarmed, they're being shot down by the soldiers. In the background is the old state house, the symbol of the authority here, the legitimate government here. And then the church, the first church, is hovering in the background of that. So you have the ecclesiastical authority, the civil authority, being usurped by arbitrary power. Pelham's title, The Fruits of Arbitrary Power. And he wants to have an engraving made so that he can sell them. So he takes his print, or his engraving, down to Paul Revere. And Revere copies it. He makes an engraving of it. And he puts his name at the bottom, engraved by Paul Revere. And Revere sells them. And at the bottom, there is a little poem about the horrors of the massacre, also reminding everyone about Ebenezer Richardson killing Christopher Sider and selling thousands of these. It becomes the most popular engraving of the period. Later on in the year, in the fall, when there's a trial of the soldiers, one of the judges comments on the copper plate engraving, which has inflamed the public mind. People see the drawing and they think, well, this is exactly what happened. The story is somewhat different. You know, you have this angry mob. You look at Revere's engraving. No one is armed, and it's a very well-dressed crowd. You know, we know of the victims. I know there's an apprentice, Maverick. There's two sailors, Benjamin Caldwell and Crispus Attucks. And sailors at that time were on the lowest level of the social. I don't even think they were on the social ladder yet. Samuel Johnson said the only men who go to sea are those who cannot contrive to get themselves into prison. So, and then there's a rope worker. Patrick Carr, the rope worker. So it's a tough group here. And in the drawing, they look like a fairly respectable, prosperous group, and they're all unarmed. There's even a little dog. It's as if someone's out walking his dog, and these soldiers open fire. Much different because it is a propaganda piece. It's an attempt to convince us. This is what happens when you have arbitrary authority here. It's not a lawless mob. These are legitimate folks out, you know, exercising their legitimate rights.
Now, you mentioned lawless mob, and that kind of reminds me of other work I've read by folks like Alfred Young, who talk about the Boston Tea Party, and how they kind of didn't talk about that for a really long time because it was a lawless mob. Now, is the Boston Massacre something that the post-revolutionary generation sort of avoids talking about? Is it something they're embarrassed about?
Interestingly enough, no. The Boston Massacre is something they will talk about because of the way, well, almost immediately, it is presented as this case of arbitrary power or usurpation of power. It becomes it becomes the first event, and you have this engraving that everyone knows. In fact, in 1776, when the British are occupying Boston and Washington orders the guns placed on Dorchester Heights, this is done on the night of March the 4th. On March the 5th, Washington exhorts the troops, saying, "You men of Boston, will you allow them to triumph on the 5th of March?" And of course they won't, because everyone knows the significance of the 5th of March, because Boston began observing the 5th of March in 1771. All the church bells in town toll on March the 5th. People put up illuminations. Thomas Hutchinson, the governor, is quite outraged at this. He says it shows how badly they understand the meaning of the day. Now, for him, it was still a mob. For the Bostonians, it has become something else. And every year there is an oration, which doesn't talk a lot about the victims. It doesn't talk about these victims as being these, you know, working guys, rope workers, and so on. Instead, it talks about them as being victims of arbitrary power. So that's the way it becomes remembered. Not, you know, a bunch of lawless people who get what's coming to them because they should have known better than to be confronting soldiers. Instead, it is the fact that this was an unarmed crowd being fired on by British authority. So Boston, early on, starts remembering this differently from the way it remembers the Boston Tea Party, which is called the destruction of the tea and not the Tea Party, and no one really knows who these Mohawks were. But no, it's because Boston consciously tries to remember the 5th of March. Everyone knows the significance of the 5th of March. In fact, every year, as I said, there's an oration about the meaning of March 5th. And the first orator, I think, is John Lovell, who is one of the teachers at Boston Latin School. Joseph Warren does it a couple of times. Benjamin Church. Some of the most prominent people in the political community are the orators. In 1773, they asked John Adams to give the oration. He turned it down because, of course, he had been the guy who defended the soldiers at their trial.
Now bringing up John Adams, that kind of leads me to my next question. This ends up going to court because, you know, people die. That's an important. John Adams is involved in that court case. And he's not involved in a way that a lot of people expect him to be involved.
You know, there are two things happening. First, you have Ebenezer Richardson sitting in jail. And everyone knows he is going to hang as soon as he's tried. He shot Christopher Sider. But now you have the soldiers. As I said, Governor Hutchinson spends the night hearing witnesses. By early the next morning, he orders Captain Preston and the 8 soldiers arrested and charged with murder because they had shot down unarmed civilians in the street. So there are two cases, Rex versus Preston, the case against Captain Preston, and Rex versus Wems, the case against Corporal Wems and the 7 soldiers. You know, they're all in jail. They keep putting off the sessions until the fall. Now, meanwhile, you have Samuel Quincy, who's going to be the prosecutor of the case. His brother, Josiah Quincy, is going to defend the soldiers. And Quincy agrees to defend the soldiers if John Adams will be his co-counsel. And Adams lives longer than Quincy does, so we have his account of this, or his recollection of this, when someone came to him asking if he could defend Thomas Preston, saying that here's a man sitting in jail on trial for his life and no one in town will represent him. And Adams says, counsel is the last thing any man should want in a free country. He and Quincy want to show that soldiers who kill unarmed civilians in Boston can get a fair trial. Remember, the pretext for having the soldiers here is it's a lawless town. You can't have, you know, the courts don't work. The law doesn't work. You need soldiers to keep the peace. Well, if you can show that these soldiers can get a fair trial, that negates that whole argument about why you need the soldiers here in the first place. So Adams and Quincy will defend the soldiers as a way of showing the legitimacy of the courts here and the fact that it is a peaceful, law-abiding community. We don't need soldiers because we obey the law. So Adams and Quincy will defend Captain Preston and the soldiers. And this fellow, in getting Adams to appear as counsel, you know, tells him that, you know, Captain Preston probably can't pay you much, and Adams says he doesn't want to be paid for this. In a case like this, he said any lawyer should despise a fee. And then the fellow goes a little too far and says to Adams, of course he's innocent. And Adams says, well, that is for the jury to determine.
And how is he found?
Preston is found not guilty. In fact, there are two separate trials. And you think, okay, Adams and Quincy are lawyers both for Preston and the soldiers. The easy thing to do would be first show Preston didn't give the order to fire, therefore he's not guilty. And then in the next case say, you know, well, the soldiers thought that Preston gave the order to fire, and then they would be found not guilty. But what they do is they argue in both cases the mob provoked this. Adams and Quincy put the mob on trial, showing, you know, hearing these witnesses about the stones being thrown, people wanting to go and attack the soldiers, wanting to attack the barracks. And Adams really blames not the Bostonians, but outsiders, an addicts from Framingham, a car from Ireland, and talks about these outsiders who come and give the good people of Boston a bad name. Also says it shouldn't surprise us that there's a mob in Boston. And he says that the mob actually had been provoked by the soldiers. Masterful piece of legal work. Should point out in the prosecution, you know, Samuel Quincy is assisted by Robert Treat Paine. You know, Robert Treat Paine is, like Adams, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And Paine's whole argument is that these soldiers shouldn't have been here. They were a provocation, and they brought it on themselves. Adams's argument is, you know, yes, the soldiers are a provocation, but the mob was attacking them. So it's a wonderful piece. It's actually the longest case ever held in America up till that time. It's the first case that goes longer than a day. This is the case of Rex versus Wems. Preston is found not guilty, and of the soldiers, 2 are found guilty of manslaughter. The rest are found not guilty. Kilroy and Montgomery, the ones who had shown did fire their guns, are found guilty of manslaughter, And then Adams pleads benefit of clergy, which is a legal defense. If you can read, you can be, you know, you're not subject to trial in a civil court. However, to prevent someone who has pled benefit of clergy and gotten off once from doing it again, they're branded on the thumb with an M for manslaughter. So Montgomery and Kilroy in the fall branded on their thumbs, and then by this time the soldiers have been taken out of town. They've been sent to New Jersey, and Montgomery and Kilroy branded on the thumbs, sent to New Jersey, and that might have been punishment enough, but that's the end of it.
So the soldiers are removed, which is...
Well, actually, the soldiers were removed in March. In fact, on March the 6th, Governor Hutchinson convenes the governor's council. See what you do. Now he has a crisis. He is told that there are 10,000 people in the surrounding towns waiting, ready to come to Boston to drive the soldiers out, unless you do something, unless you get them out of town. And Hutchinson says, well, I don't have the authority to get them out of town. They're under the authority of General Gage, who's down in New York. And then someone says, look, there are these 10,000 people going to come into town to drive them out, unless you do something. And Hutchinson says, well, these soldiers were from the 14th Regiment. Maybe I'll get the 14th Regiment moved to Castle Island. Now, Samuel Adams, who comes representing the town of Boston, says, you just told us you couldn't move the soldiers because they're under the orders of General Gage. Now you've told us you can move one regiment. Well, if you can move one regiment, you can move both. And Adams is a very good negotiator. So, yeah, the soldiers are first moved to Castle Island. Then Gage has them dispatched to New Jersey, getting them out of town because in town they were going to be subject to, further mobs, further violence. As a way of preventing violence, the soldiers are moved out of town.
So what ends up being the legacy of the Boston Massacre? How does it affect the rest of the revolutionary movement, and why is it still important?
There are a couple of reasons why the Boston Massacre is still important. First, it shows this confrontation between civilians and armed soldiers, a usurpation of legitimate power. And where does power come from? Does it come from, a concern on an engaged citizenry, or does it come from people who happen to have weapons? And that's the decision people are making over this decade. How will we be governed? Will we be governed by arbitrary force, or will we be governed by laws of our own making? That's one piece of it. Politically, it becomes important because Samuel Adams is a master at propaganda, writing the town's report on this, which calls it a horrid massacre, getting Paul Revere's engraving spread. And then even it enters into the political realm with Governor Hutchinson and the governor's council saying, publishing or sending to England their notes of this meeting where someone on the governor's council said, hey, there are 10,000 people in the surrounding towns. And Hutchinson argues that this shows there is a conspiracy actually to bring these 10 to 20,000 people to town. Well, there wasn't. This becomes a major political issue, and it becomes a major part of the public memory as every year March the 5th is commemorated with tolling of bells and with illuminations and speeches and other things. So up until 1776, every year on March the 5th, this is a major piece of Boston memory. And then through the revolutionary years, in fact, in 1783, once it's clear that the British are going to make peace, we've won the Revolutionary War, at the Boston town meeting, James Otis moves on March the 5th of 1783, henceforward, instead of commemorating March the 5th, let's commemorate July 4th. So it's that piece of the public memory that makes it important. The Revere engraving, which is the most widely published engraving of the massacre of the revolutionary period. It is the most familiar image of the revolutionary period. Everyone sees this, and even if they can't connect all the dots, civil power, ecclesiastical power, arbitrary power, can see British soldiers firing at unarmed civilians. So that's what makes it part of the public memory.
That's been a great summary of the Boston Massacre. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Matt. Take care.
You can learn more about Robert Allison's work and writings by visiting his website, robertallisonhistory.com. That's robertallisonhistory, all one word, .com. Thank you for listening to the Freedom Trail podcast. Generous funding was provided by the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Learn more at www.massteacher.org. The Bloody Massacre at King Street was performed by Sam Jones, Anna Waldron, Nate Gundy, Michael Costello, and Tim Hoover. Our guests today were Samantha Nelson of the Bostonian Society and Robert Allison of Suffolk University. Music for this podcast was graciously provided by Middlesex County Volunteers Fifes and Drums, mcvfifesanddrums.org, and Poor Richard's Penny, poorrichardspenny.com. The podcast was created by the Freedom Trail Foundation, thefreedomtrail.org. And hosted by Matt Wilding. We apologize for any audio errors. We are a nonprofit, and the media department is one guy. Email us with ideas and tips at info@thefreedomtrail.org.